Your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Merry meet and merry part, bright the cheeks and warm the heart. For tread the circle thrice about to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight we're going to be talking about New World Witchery with my guest, Corey Hutchison. Now, he's the co-host of a popular podcast, The New World Witchery, and he has a doctorate in American Studies with specializations in folklore, religion, and ethnicity from Penn State, and he's a contributor to the Oxford Handbook of American Folklore and Folklore Studies, and American Myths, Legends, and Tall Tales. He's written for several public occult publications, including Witches and Pagans. And for those who are listening live, you can pop over to paraxradionetwork.com and join the chat room, where you can post a question to Corey or exchange thoughts with and comments with the people in the chat room denizens as well. So, Corey, step out of the shadows and welcome.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, you owed me that because I got the book and it was so heavy. I got a hernia. And so, you know, it's the least that you can do to kind of show up and tell everybody about it.
It's not just a book. It's a workout material. You can use it as a yoga block or as a you know, for bench pressing. It's good for many things.
So. I noticed that. And yeah, and I swear the first reaction that I had when I picked up this book was, wow. You know, it's a big book, both in size and in content. I mean, there's 22 chapters and over 400 pages and 500 samples of folklore, and all that stuff's really amazing. And it just, did the book start out to be as comprehensive as it turned out to be?
It actually started out bigger. My editors actually were very, they were very diplomatic, but also very, very clear. Like, it can't be as big as you want it to be. It needs to be something we can actually sell to human beings that can lift it and carry it out of the store. So I wound up trimming a good 20,000 or so words out of my first draft, to get it kind of close to where it is now. So it was bigger. It's, this is the condensed version, believe it or not. So,
It's hard to believe. Well, you know, as the book cover says, it's a trove of North American folk magic, and aptly so, because by definition, I mean, a trove is a store of valuable and delightful things, and delightful is a great adjective to describe this book. I mean, there's stories, there's artifacts, there's rituals, there's beliefs. Going by the huge bibliography in the back of the book, you did tons and tons of research. And it must have taken you maybe forever, almost, just to do the first draft?
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, we'd been doing the podcast for about 10 years at the time that I got the book contract, and I had already started working on a version of the book at that point. And it took about a year and a half to put everything together from the time when I got the contract to the, you know, turning in the draft that would eventually become the book. But really, the research had been going on for a good almost decade prior to that. So there's a lot of stuff crammed in there for sure.
So you knew where to look for research too. It wasn't like you were, you know, where do I go here? What do I do now?
No, you have... no, I, yeah, I, you know, I've got this sort of scholarly training. So, you know, take notes every time I read. And I had a, you know, database, a spreadsheet, kind of pulling a bunch of stuff together. So I knew kind of exactly where I wanted to find different pieces of information and pull them into the book and things like that. So it helped to be a little bit organized, I think, with that much material to kind of work with.
Yeah. I mean, there's just crazy amount in there. all right. So you've said that you've always been obsessed about witches and obsessed in what we do, as in magic. Is that what led you into folklore, or was it the other way around?
I think they were kind of hand in hand. I mean, even from a very young age, you know, I've always kind of believed that there's enchantment to be found in the world. And so that sense of enchantment lends itself to kind of a sort of fairy tale worldview in some ways. And I want to emphasize, like, when I say that, I'm not thinking, you know, all singing mice and happy princesses. Like, fairy tales often are very dark and very scary things. So magic has two edges, or has more than one edge, I guess I should say. Sure. So it could be a little terrifying at times, but it was always kind of wondrous as well. And so I would go looking for these sort of hints of magic in the world. And in doing that, I discovered, you know, oh, there's this stuff called folklore that seems to be really, really tied up in magical worldviews and magical beliefs. And the more I got into that, the more I was like, oh, fairy tales are fantastic. Oh, there are also these kind of myths and legends. Oh, there's fables. Oh, there's folk beliefs. There's traditions and celebrations, and there's festivals and parades and holidays. All this stuff just, you know, became this fountain of joy that sort of fed me really from the time I was, you know, 8-9 years old. So yeah, that's kind of where it all started for me.
Good start. Yeah. start them young, and then they just keep growing.
Oh yeah.
Your journey began at the crossroads, you said, and that makes this book That makes the book a crossroads, and the readers will be starting their journeys at the crossroads as well. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the crossroads. Crossroads, because they're always amazing, and to call the book a crossroads, and you know, I want to hear more.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the crossroads. I mean, I think a lot of people, at least if they're thinking about kind of American folklore, they may sort of have this association with the crossroads and Robert Johnson or Tommy Johnson, kind of depending on the version of the legend that you find, and the idea that, you know, you quote unquote sell your soul to the devil to get this musical talent. He was a blues man, and so he gained this sort of magical level of musical talent way back in the, I think it was the 20s or the 30s. And so that kind of idea that, like, this is a place where magical deals get made, right? You know, the crossroads was, you know, where they sometimes would hang criminals. So it was a place that where it was dangerous, but it was also a place where people from different villages, you know, would meet people that were not from where they were as well. It was kind of a slightly wild space. There was there were, you know, things there that you might not encounter anywhere else. We've got, you know, associations with Hecate and the Trivium, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there's all these kind of things that get tied up in this image of a crossroads, which is wonderful because it's what we would call a liminal space, a space between right. spaces where anything, any possibility is right there waiting to happen. And so with the book, what I wanted to do, particularly in the very beginning of the book, I wanted to set it up so that you go through kind of this very first section so you kind of know what the book is. But then at that point, you really follow wherever you're led within the book. So if you're interested in more modern, contemporary types of folk magic, you'll kind of go straight to the back, right? If you're interested in the sort of crafts that are made in folk magic, there's a section of the book that you can jump to and start talking about that. If you're interested mm-hmm. in flight, which flight, you can jump into that as well. So you can kind of move wherever you want to at that point.
Well, it's funny you just mentioned flight, because I just got a chat room question, and she said, could you ask your guest, what are the secrets to allowing a person to fly with or without a broom?
Sure. I mean, it's important to understand that there's a lot of different, you know, putting my scholar hat on, there's a lot of different scholarly debate about what that means, witch flight. And then, you know, there's also, you know, putting my witch hat on, there's a lot of different ways to kind of get into this kind of flight state of mind as well. So from the scholarly perspective, I know there's a kind of a popular belief out there in the world that, you know, the brooms were greased up with witch's grease and used to sort of anoint the genitals and things like that. We don't have strong evidence that that's, you know, true. It may have happened a few times at some point in history, but we do know that these greases, these witches' ointments, these flying ointments were made, and that they seem to be used to create these kind of altered states of mind, these sort of almost hallucinogenic states. And that during these, people would have remarkably similar experiences where they had visions of themselves kind of going out of their body, flying through the night, meeting with other people like them in kind of high places on mountains or wild places like in the woods, and encountering other magical peoples, other magical creatures and things like that, and sort of sharing sort of the revelries there. So we have that. And then in terms of like, how do we do that today? I mean, there are still people who are making these flying ointments. Sarah Lawless she's a person who makes these kind of online apothecary things, and she has some really wonderful flying ointments, and she's very, very careful about dosages, right? Because mm-hmm. there are some very toxic things in some flying ointments.
Yes.
So you have to be careful. You can't just go out willy-nilly and be like, oh, man, Drake, I'm just going to cram that in this jar. that's not going to end well for you. But there are other ways to do it, too. Some of the really interesting ways I found are involving dreaming. If you can sort of get yourself into a state of lucid dreaming, that can be really, really effective. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to kind of stimulate the sort of sense of witch flight and sort of control where you want to go and, you know, who do you want to meet? What kind of encounters do you want to have as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and somebody just wrote in the chat, so it sounds a bit like a version of astral projection.
It's not far off, right? I mean, I think there are people who would draw some distinctions, but yeah, that's it's you know, if we're talking kind of in big loose terms, yeah, it sort of resembles that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've ever read any of his stuff. Thomas Hatzis, he's written books about drugs and witchcraft, and he had one book that talked a whole lot about the witch's ointment. I think that was the name of the book, by the way, the witch's ointment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, there's so many different facets to it that we could do a whole show on that. But I've got more other things to talk about, too.
Sure.
just a few, like, you know, 50. So in chapter one, you talk about how people should read the book. And that's, I've never seen that in a book. Well, here's my book. Here's how you should read it. But you're right. I mean, because this isn't, like you said, exactly a cover to cover type book. And, mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned to you earlier that I'm going to be bringing up bits and pieces of things that caught my eye, as going through it. And that's one of the reasons, or one of the ways to look at the book, look at the table of contents. Something will jump out at you. Or,
oh, yeah.
You know, what's really fun is bibliomance.
Yeah,
you know,
sure,
just
yeah,
open the book and see where you find you when you're, oh my God, today I'm really dumbed. but yeah, it's the way it's even broken down is so methodical. You know, mm-hmm. like you said, you get that little scholarly bit. And, yes. You know, it's amazing. And so I think, you know, if I'm doing it that way, I'm hoping that's the right way to do it. But that kind of leads me into the 12 rites that the book is divided into. You want to mm-hmm. explain that?
Sure. That's a little bit of a it's a little bit of a performance on my part, just because as I was putting it together, I realized that they were falling into, there's actually kind of 13 quote unquote rites in there, just that the last one is sort of buried in the coda. But the idea is, as I sort of put this book together, I was like, oh, some of these things really have an affinity for one another. So if you're talking about, for example, divination, well, there's the divination that I think a lot of us normally think of, right? Which is, you know, using tarot cards or, you know, maybe doing pendulum dowsing and things like that. And then you have kind of the folkloric forms of that, which might be like water dowsing with the forked rod. But then there were also there's this whole other tradition of divination that involved treasure hunting, particularly North American history, North American folk magic. And so as I saw those things sort of as two separate chapters, I thought, well, really, they form a complete picture of this idea of a second sight, right? A sort of an ability to see things that other people can't. And so I sort of looked at a lot of the different chapters and realized, oh, well, I can group them in this interesting way. And if you follow through, this is kind of a little quote unquote secret of the book, right? The end of each chapter, there's something called the work, which is this kind of, it's practical, but it's not necessarily It's not like just a spell that you do. It's sort of a reflective time where you may do some journaling about something, or you might write some ideas down, but you may also do a practical exercise that's included with that. And if you follow that, what I have found is that if you kind of work through all of those different sections, you wind up with a pretty complete starter practice of witchcraft, right? A pretty complete way to begin working with folk magic in your witchcraft, which allows you to kind of cover a lot of the different bases. And you get to discover which ones work best for you, too, because you may not like everything about it, too.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just absolutely tantalizing, because there's the rites, and then there's the second part of it where you're telling everybody about the exercises and all that good stuff, and all the different chapters, what they can find there. Every one of them has dirt under the nails. You want to explain that?
Sure. I sort of stole that from Aidan Wachter, who has this amazing book, Six Ways, and he just put out another one, Weaving Fate. He's sort of a chaos magician slash folk magician, and he blends those two fields really, really well. But he talks about you have to kind of get your hands dirty and get some dirt under the nails when you're doing magic. And I was like, boy, that's very true for how I practice, because like when I put together a charm packet or something like that, by the time I'm done, my hands are filthy because I've been, you know, squishing up herbs and using ink and, you know, candles and soot and things like that. So they're just messy. And I think sometimes we want witchcraft to be Instagram perfect. You know, we want it to look really pretty and pristine, but it's messy. It's a very messy thing to do magic. And so I wanted to call those little practical exercises dirt under the nails, because I want people not to be afraid to go out and just do this work, go out and try it out. You know, make Four Thieves vinegar, for example. You know, go and get your bottle of cider vinegar and cram your stuff into it, shake it up. You're going to wind up smelling a little bit like vinegar sometimes, because you're going to get it on you. That's okay. That's, you know, a good witch maybe does smell a little like vinegar from time to time. That's okay.
I think we should
people to do that. Yeah, yes. Right?
Yeah, or worse even. It just depends on the spell and what's in the cauldron.
Right.
Got a question, too, that just came in. How is folk magic doing in the 21st century? Is technology entering into it, or are people pretty much sticking to the tried and true old ways?
Well, so there's been a real resurgence of interest in it. I'll say that a lot of people are very interested in reclaiming folk magic, sometimes from their specific communities. So, for example, Brujeria has had a real resurgence. I think you had Jay Allen Cross on recently.
I did, yes. Yeah. Great book.
And he's done some really great work with that. And then, you know, so there's an interest in it. TikTok, there's a whole lot of people who are sharing kind of pieces of folk magic from their communities and their work. That being said, there's also a proliferation of stuff where I would say people are claiming it's folk magic, but it's not actually found in any kind of folklore. It's just kind of something that they've made up, and they're claiming it as folk magic. And to be fair, all magic, you know, started off made up somewhere. So it may become folk magic over time if people do it. But, you know, it can be a little disingenuous to present it that way. But that being said, if it works for you, it works for you. And, you know, that's kind of the most important thing with magic. And then there have been some interesting evolutions in folk magic. I find, for example, there are this is kind of an example I give, which is, you know, it used to be when you were, you know, with your friends on the playground and you were a kid and you wanted to do a little fortune telling exercise to predict the name of your future spouse or lover or whatever it is, you take the apple and you twist the stem and you'd say a letter for each twist of the stem until it came off. And, you know, if it was D, okay, you were going to be with Dave, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in the 80s and 90s, as Coke machines started coming into schools, for better or worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
People started using those little pop-top tabs instead of apple stems. So they would flex those back and forth while doing the exact same thing. And when the pop-top tab came off, that was the new divination.
Mm-hmm.
Now in the 21st century, it's you can do similar kind of divinations where you have things that, you know, something that you might open up on an app will do something very, very similar and give you kind of a randomized answer, and that tells you something. Or I just had this thing presented to me this week that I thought was fascinating. There's a dog on TikTok named Noodle, who he's a little pug, and every day his owner will try to stand him up on his bed And he's 13 years old. So some days he'll stand up and some days he'll just kind of flop back over because he's so tired. And so people are starting to go like, okay, well, if Noodle has bones, in other words, if he stands up, then he is, then we're going to have a good day. But if Noodle doesn't have bones, then we need to make sure we're taking care of ourselves and be careful and things like that. It's like cute. That. It's a really cute thing, but it's entering into that realm of sort of a new creation in the digital space that's very similar to some of the stuff we've seen in folk magic for years and years and years.
Yeah, and you know, when we're talking about 21st century, the other thing too, I'm talking about geographically, because I'm wondering geographically in the United States, do you think there is more folk magic in the South as opposed to other regions? Because I mean, I've lived in Southern California all my life, and there are plenty of New Agers, but I've never come across a folk magic practitioner out here.
I mean, they're everywhere. I mean, so for one thing, you probably do have curanderas and brujos and hechiceros and salmaristas. You have those out there. You probably, I know over in Oakland, for example, there were a number of hoodoo candle shops for a while. Not currently, but I think back in the 60s and 70s, there were several. And then since then, I think in the past 10 to 15 years, there's been a small resurgence in that. So hoodoo has a home out there. So it just kind of depends. Sometimes it takes some digging. I think the South wears its magic a little more on its sleeve, although it doesn't like to call it magic a lot of the time, because there's a very strong religious conservatism, religious tradition that that sort of is like, no, these are miracles and prayers. Yes, I understand that I am, trying to heal somebody with the power of my touch, but we're not going to call that magic. So, so the South just kind of wears it a little more openly, but I think you find it everywhere.
Yeah, I guess maybe maybe it's just that we're used to having, you know, root workers and all that stuff being in the South. So, yeah. All right. Got another question from chat. Do you think that it's easier for someone to learn to use magic if your psychic abilities are inherited?
That gets tricky. I talk about that. I think it's in the chapter where I talk about initiations and things like that, because there is a strong tradition in at least American folklore and American history of people that are born with what we'd say sort of a gift or a touch, or they have the second sight already sort of built into them. Some people are born with a call, for example, or the seventh son of a seventh son. Lots of things that do sort of form this sort of hereditary inheritance of magic. But we've always had people who can also pick up magic just because they sort of have an inclination towards it. So a dowser, for example, somebody who can find water using a forked stick. Sure, if their grandfather was a dowser, that might make it easier for them. But there are lots of dowsers who, you know, don't have anybody directly in their line that can do it, and they pick up the stick, and all of a sudden it's bouncing in their hands, and it's just something that they've got a natural knack to do. And there are some people. Mm-hmm. A good example of this is Zora Neale Hurston, who was an anthropologist back in the 20s and 30s, worked in the Works Project Administration. Did a bunch of sort of folklore research there. She did a whole survey of hoodoo in the South, and she would just kind of go into these communities and learn and practice with them to understand this magic a little better. And she became very, very good at it. So I think you can, if it's something that you feel called to because of an interest, there's no reason that you can't pick up magic that way too. And does having the ability make it easier? I think for some people, sure, it does. But I think some people, that can feel like a curse too. It can feel like a burden to have that ability and not know what to do with it for a long time until they find something that fits. Whereas if you have an interest and a passion that you can pursue, then sometimes that makes it a little easier to enter into magic kind of on your own terms in that situation.
So, okay. So how interested in magic are you? I mean, are you a practitioner or just, you know, getting all the information and learning about it? I mean, I know you have a partner that is, but what about you?
No, I'm a practitioner. Now, I don't practice Wicca. I practice basically folk magic, and I'm sort of an animist at heart. But you know, the things that I practice are very much sort of within that folk magic realm. But at the same time, I also have an academic side, so I wind up studying folk magic from lots of different places. And I'm, you know, I kind of bump into stuff where I'm like, oh, I recognize that from a tradition that I am already a part of, and maybe I'll do kind of that version of it. Mm-hmm. Or I'll bump into something and say, oh, that's a really fascinating thing. I've not really seen that before, and try to learn more about it. I'm fascinated in all of it, and I kind of practice a subset of it that's more sort of specific to me.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of us are kind of eclectic in, you know, taking bits and pieces from different paths and stuff. And I think that's kind of the best way to go. You know, you don't have the blinders on then. You're learning all the time. And that's important, because if you don't know what other people are doing, it may be something that you should be doing or you want to be doing, but you never learned about it. So, yeah, I think it's...
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's true. I think we have to also remember to be respectful of those cultures when we encounter them too. So, you know, cherry picking something out of a culture and pulling it out of context is always going to, one, weaken the magic itself, because if you're just taking the shiny part of it, then you may be missing the deeper roots of it, right? If you're just taking the flower, mm-hmm. you may never understand where the roots are coming from.
Yeah.
And two, you know, we have to listen to people when they say, you know, no, this practice is not available to everyone. Well, okay, so is it something where we can learn about it, kind of, and see? Okay, I see a mirror for that practice in this other space that I do have access to. And if that's the case, then we can kind of approach it that way. There's nothing wrong with learning about magic from any place, but we do want to be careful not to, you know, trample over someone else's cultural experience, you know, while we're doing this as well.
No, exactly. I mean, we have to not do that for sure. But okay, another chat room question. Is there a great difference between folk magic and the magic that some of us practice that we don't necessarily consider to be folk magic?
I mean, there's that longstanding kind of separation where people will talk about, you know, quote unquote, high magic or low magic. And folk magic is often kind of the low magic. High magic is the ceremonial magic. Wicca does a really neat job. If people are kind of talking about that kind of magic, the sort of religious witchcraft, spiritual witchcraft form of magic, where it blends some of that ceremonial stuff into the folk magic, or some of the it's sort of a chocolate and peanut butter thing, right? They can get some of the chocolate and the peanut butter, and it makes it better, right? Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there are traditions of witchcraft that use little bits of folk magic, but then also bring in some of that sort of ceremonial stuff that we find in something like, for example, Wicca or Thelema or some of those traditions as well. So are there differences? I think folk magicians oftentimes are going to be, you know, they're not going to be concerned with casting a circle before they do a spell, right?
Right.
They're not going to be concerned necessarily with following eight Sabbats on a wheel of the year, because they're going to have local traditions that are more important to them than that sort of eight Sabbat structure. Mm-hmm. There still will be an affinity. There'll still be things that you could look at from both traditions and say, oh, okay, so they're in conversation with one another. They're similar. They have things that they can learn from one another.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people think folk magic is mostly root work and using tools that are handy, you know, rather than going to an occult shop and buying tools. You know, you make your own wands, you use different herbs and everything that you don't buy, you pick them and you dry them and whatever. So maybe mm-hmm. that's how people see folk magic, as kind of the old world way mm-hmm. of doing things, as opposed to going in and buying some crystals and stuff. When somebody said, why buy crystals? There's a lot of rocks for free on the road.
For sure. I totally agree with some of the most powerful, I don't use a lot of crystals in my practice, because the things that I find more powerful are things like, for example, have you ever heard of like a hagstone or a holy stone?
Yeah. Oh, I love those. I've got one right in front of me right now.
So wonderful for working mm-hmm. otherworldly forces. But, but for some people, that's not going to appeal to them. They want the quartz point, and that's okay. That's their version of that magic. And I would never say like, oh, that's totally wrong, because it does work for other people, right? It's just mm-hmm. two different ways of approaching the problem.
Yeah. It's picking up something off the ground and having polished crystals.
Nothing wrong with either version of that.
Yeah, it's just the way you are. Okay, we are going to take a short break, but let me ask you one more question that came in real quick. Can you inherit magical systems from past life relatives?
That's a really good question. I'll say I have seen in some Southern traditions, there's a sort of belief that, for example, a grandparent or a great-grandparent passes within a family line some magical ability. But in terms of like really ancient past lives, if you have a past life where you feel like you were an ancient Egyptian, would you suddenly inherit the sort of Egyptian style of folk magic? I've not seen that in my research. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that I have nothing that I can draw from or point to or compare it to say like, oh yes, I definitely think that exists. I think that would be wonderful if somebody wants to explore that. I'd be fascinated in reading that.
Yeah. Well, it just, you never know. We carry the same DNA supposedly through our blood going back generations and generations and generations. So maybe if it's in the DNA and we don't know where exactly it comes from, but that could be, it's just.
Yeah, it's possible. I just don't know.
Yeah, inherited. All right. Well, we're going to take a short breather and we'll be back in 2 minutes. So everybody, please stay put.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back. So don't go away. If you end up with webbed feet, remember, you've been warned. Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witches Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the paranormal view, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear. Line.
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
That's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, thank you all for sticking around. And for those who've just joined us late, my guest is Corey Hutchison, and we're talking about his book, New World Witchery. Got another question from the chat room. I'll just throw it right now because otherwise it might fly away.
Sure.
What do you think of the history and use of having a black cat, especially a black cat, to use as a familiar or as in spells?
Sure. I mean, so black cats do have a long and both illustrious and sometimes quite infamous history within folk magic. So you have a lot of stories of witches who will, transmute their shape into a black cat to go gallivanting about. It's sort of a different version of witch flight, right? Mm-hmm. There's spells, for example, in hoodoo, there are spells that use black cat hair and black dog hair to do things like breakup spells or certain types of jinxes or even luck work. There's some luck work that flows around there. There's a really infamous, and I'm not advocating this ritual at all, but there's a really infamous ritual that involves cooking a black cat alive to get a sort of magical bone out of its body. But again, not advocating. I'm just saying that is a thing that we find in folklore. So
that sounds like Voldemort and Harry Potter.
It sure does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's fine. Yeah. I think anytime somebody bumps into that the first time, they're like, "What is this?" But it's important to remember, you know, just because something was used in the past doesn't mean we use it today. We can learn and grow, and we know, you know, doing violence to animals, I mean, you know, doing harm and torture to animals is not a good, not a good way to go about getting getting magic to work for you in this day and age, for sure. So yeah, so black cats have that kind of connection and that kind of history. In terms of making it a familiar, I mean, familiars are oftentimes they're part of the initiation process in witch lore. So I mean, I think it would. I don't think you could. I don't know that you could set out to turn your existing black cat into your familiar, at least not kind of based on the lore that I've seen. But it's possible that, like, after a particularly powerful witchy experience, you might suddenly have a black cat show up. And that might be an indication that this thing has that connection for you. That would be a little more in line with what we see in the folklore side of things.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so I mentioned earlier I was going to bring up some things that caught my eye as I wandered through the book and my fingers did the walking. And to start off, I'd like to find out more about spirit water and leaving a glass of water near the bed at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, I mean, it's a pretty common practice. We see leaving, for example, a glass of water on an ancestor altar is a pretty frequent practice in a lot of different traditions.
Yeah, I do that.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. Doing one near you while you sleep, there are a lot of folk beliefs about things like crossing water. Oftentimes, it's more centered on running water. But if you leave water near your bed, it becomes something that can kind of absorb and distract spirits, for lack of a better term. So if you have something that maybe would be coming in to do harm to you, if you have a glass of water out next to your bed, sometimes it's a really good way of sort of preventing that spirit from quite reaching you. And then you can sort of dump it out in the morning and get rid of those sort of harmful influences. It also, if you do happen to be doing sort of spirit journeying work, for example, witch flight or something like that, having water as a sort of, it's sort of like when you enter this sort of inner landscape, right? That sort of becomes like a lake, right? The knowing where the water is sort of like knowing where the watering hole is, knowing where the lake is, knowing where the ocean is. Gives you a sense of direction. So it gives you a way to get home. So it can be a way of finding your way back that way.
Okay. Now you have an exercise about the witch's mark. And way back when, you know, they were considered proof that someone was a witch during the burning times and the witch hunts. But when you get to thinking about it, nobody has a perfect body.
Right.
And everybody's got some kind of imperfection. So if you look hard enough, you'll find something. And that's probably what they were doing from, you know, way back when. But let's talk a little bit about the witch's mark in general and then explain how we can turn a little imperfection into a witch's mark, because that was really interesting for me.
Sure. Yeah. So this is one of the exercises that's in the book. And yeah, you're right. This is something where when you had the sort of witch hunters, the Matthew Hopkinses of the world, right? They were going out, and oftentimes they were, you know, basically looking for whatever they could find to sort of prove their point, right? That this is a this is a witch, and this particular mark somehow sets them apart and makes them clearly, you know, the evil thing that we're trying to hunt down and kill, et cetera, right? But I mean, this is something as simple as, you know, you might have a skin tag, right? You might have a birthmark. We have my youngest child has what we call stork bites on the back of their neck from when they were born. It's kind of a birthmark that they get. Those kinds of things could be easily weaponized against people by their enemies to turn them into. I mean, there are even all these kind of things where, like, freckles can be misread this way. So there's a lot of folk magic where people are actually doing things to try to remove freckles from their body, which is so funny that they're using magic to try to remove these things that would then be used against them to prove that they were doing magic. But you know, all of that, I like the idea of reclaiming and sometimes sort of reversing the tide of those trends. And so we now live in an age where I think you can take whatever it is about you that sets you apart, that makes you a little different, something that maybe you, you know, that people have told you is ugly, or something that people have told you is gross, or that, you know, you feel self-conscious about. If you just look at it and imagine it as something that is sort of a magical thing about you, a little existing piece of magic living in your body, living in your skin, something that is embodied within you, that can be a really, really powerful way of you know, loving yourself, right? Of really getting into your body and showing your body, I like you literally warts and all, right? I like you exactly as you are. And then I find that, you know, if you do that, if you kind of invest this energy in that, it sort of seems to call out to other people. So I feel like sometimes it winds up helping to help you make new witchy friends if you have something like that you sort of reclaimed and imbued with that power. So,
yeah, and it's pretty interesting because sometimes we meet people that we suspect might be witches, but they're not. But, you know, we never just walk up to each other and say, "Hey, hi, witch." You know, I mean, that just doesn't happen. We wait for a clue. If we're looking for a little body mark or something, well, not so much these days. But, you know, I mean, you know people for weeks and months, and all of a sudden you realize, you know, the light bulb goes on your head, and oh my God, that person is a witch. And then you kind of ask in a very, well, kind of an embarrassed way, but, you know, I hate to ask you this, but, you know, are you a practitioner? You know, and then people go, "Oh yeah," and then, you know, you get together and live happily ever after.
Right. No, you'll start off with "Oh, you know, I've had a really bad day. I guess it's because Mercury's in retrograde," and you kind of give them the "What moon phase are we in?" And they're like, "Oh, we're in a waxing gibbous." And all of a sudden, both of you look at each other across the room, and you're like, "You know too, don't you?"
Yeah. Start with the astrology, and then sure. That'll work. Okay. Let me see. All right. So, bottle spells. I really love bottle spells for a variety of purposes, you know. Sure. But I've never come across anything called a souring jar. What the heck is that, and what's it for?
So it's just basically a form of a cursing jar. It's a somewhat newer take on an older style of magic where people would use things like alum or lemons, things that sort of make you pucker, right? That make you make your mouth sort of tighten up. And they would use those to stop gossip, particularly, or stop people from, you know, spreading slander or malicious lies about them. And they could also use them to sort of, make somebody's life a little more sour and sort of, unpleasant. It's not the kind of curse where all of a sudden their house is going to fall down around them, right? They're not going to get like a mysterious house fire, or it's not going to, you know, be attacked by wild dogs. It's not that level of curse. It's just making them a little bit uncomfortable, making it harder for them to do whatever harm they're doing already. So oftentimes it's used against people who are gossiping, or maybe people who have taken advantage of you or your generosity, and you're just trying to keep them from doing that again. And so you put their name in a jar full of, for example, vinegar, right? You leave their little name paper or a photo of them in this jar of vinegar. You may add some other things, like you want to make it a little spicy. You can add some chili pepper or something in there too. Every once in a while, you shake it up. Shake it up just so that they feel it for a minute. They really kind of feel this moment of like, ugh, things are not going well today, right? And then hopefully over time their behavior will change. And then the goal really is, at some point you take them out of the jar. You really are planning at some point to take them out of the jar once they have stopped being a problem. And this can be a method of sort of like training them. It's almost like, you know, when the psychologist trained the rat in the maze. This is sort of like, okay, well, every time I gossip about Corey, gosh, things just go to crap the next day. And then like eventually every time they're like, "I'm just not going to say anything about Corey. Something's really, something's telling me not to do that." And at that point you're like, good, it worked. Lesson learned. Let's move on.
No, that's true. I like that idea. I'm going to have to go back and study that and get really good at it because there are just some people sometimes they need it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'll go jump and before I get my foot in my mouth, I'll change the subject. there's lots of folklore about witches and the devil being in cahoots, but yes. Is that lore referring to the Christian devil? Because now many witches they say they don't believe in the devil, fire and brimstone and all that. Mm-hmm. So when people are talking in folklore about witches and devils, are they talking about just an evil being, but not the Lucifer or, the Beelzebub that Christianity brought?
Right. Well, and that's the problem is, right? So there's so many names, so many terms we can use. This is a section of the book that's got me a little bit of hot water with some folks because they think that I'm saying like, oh, to be a witch, you must work with the devil. And it's not true. That's not true at all.
Right, right.
If you look in the folklore, there are a lot of situations where witches are interacting with the devil. But in fact, 9 times out of 10 in these stories, the witches are outsmarting the devil, right? They're entering into something where the devil, like they have made contact with a folk devil creature of some kind who is not mm-hmm. sort of the all powerful Al-Shaitan of the sort of Christian sort of complex of religions. It's not that kind of like super adversary to God kind of, it's this little kind of local, it's almost like a local imp, right? It's the local version of the devil who likes to come up and just stir up trouble every once in a while. So he's more of a trickster figure than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll encounter him and they'll maybe get something out of it. He may act as kind of an initiator for them to kind of move them into the next phase of whatever they're doing. But then they'll, there's a story, I think it was in, it's either Maryland or New Jersey, where which kind of gets into a magical battle with this devil, and then flings him, across the bay into this hole and makes this kind of big sinkhole in the bay, using her power. So this is one of the situations where the devil is being outsmarted. Stingy Jack is another one. The one where we get the origin of the jack-o'-lantern, right? Where
the
devil keeps getting tricked, and finally, it's when Jack dies, he tries to go down to hell, and the devil's like, "Nope, you can't come in here. I do not trust you."
I didn't see it coming, but I liked it when I read it.
Yep, it's pretty good. So
it was, yeah. Okay, a favorite folkloric tale that you can give us, a little short little tale?
Sure.
Putting you on the spot, but
no, it's all right. I love, there's so many good witch stories out there. One story I really enjoy is the story of Mont and Duck Moore, who are from I believe it's Virginia, and they are they were this fun little folk magical witchy couple, where Duck was the wife, Mont was the husband. Duck was sort of more of what people would think of as a witch, right? She's this mm-hmm. person who could go and curse livestock and things like that. You could get cures from her too. She might help you find lost things, but by and large, she was the one that people feared. But they're married, and Mont was the one who would take off all the curses, right? Like, he could reverse all the curses. He could, he could remove whatever bad thing happened. And so they had this kind of racketeering system where if you made Mont mad, she would curse all your livestock and they'd start to get sick. And so then you go to Mont and be like, okay, take the curse off, and here's $100 to do it. And so he would do it, and it becomes kind of money making thing for them.
Clever.
But it's so fun. There's husband and wife, and they're both working together and kind of against each other, but it's just a really, they're such a fun couple in that capacity.
It sounds like they're very clever and very, very well along the way.
They were very smart.
Yeah, exactly. We were just talking about the devil, but it just, because we'll run out of time if I don't ask you now. Speaking of the devil, I'd like you to tell everybody about your other book too, The 54 Devils.
Sure. So that's about the folklore of fortune telling with playing cards. And it's because you have 54 cards in a deck. And I really kind of pulled that from there's a Charles Leland quote that has to do with the playing card deck being 52 devils. But I also like to include the jokers, so I make it 54.
There you go.
But the idea is that each card kind of has its own personality, and you can kind of learn these different folkloric reading systems that let you understand playing cards just as well as you could do tarot cards. You could read with playing cards just as easily. So that's really what that book is about.
Yeah, okay. Because that actually I'd probably like to have you back and talk about it, because that I've always been fascinated with playing cards as being reading cards.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I'm doing a revised edition of that. Not everybody knows that, but I'm hoping to do a revised edition out sometime next year. So yeah, that'd be awesome to come back and talk about that.
Yeah, it would, because my gram, I didn't know it until recently. She's been gone for a long time, but her granddaughter, her other granddaughter, found a whole bunch of stuff because she was really into paranormal stuff and ghosties and all that kind of stuff. And they sent me her deck of playing cards. And she had a little fortune, or not a fortune, but a little sentence or a couple of words on each card to know what they meant.
And I love that.
I don't know how she came to the conclusion of this card is for this or this card for that, but every card has, you know, sometimes it's one word, sometimes it's just a little brief sentence, and they're so worn down. But she must have used them all the time. And so, yeah, back then, I guess playing cards were very popular as fortune-telling cards, aren't they?
Well, sure. I mean, they were so ubiquitous. You could find them just everywhere. That's such a treasure. I'm so glad that you have that. I really hope that you keep that. And if you can, like, make photographs of all the cards so that you if one gets lost, you'll still know what it said and everything. Oh, I love that you have that.
I think there's one missing. Oh, there is one missing. We were kind of joking about it. Take a guess which card is missing out of that deck. Go ahead.
I'm going to guess the Joker, but it's not the Joker, is it? It's going to be like one of the King or Queens of Hearts.
No, it's the Ace of Spades.
Ace of Spades. That's a good one. Uh-huh. It's the all death right. card in the way that I read them, so that's really funny.
Yeah, that's what I of all of the cards that could have been lost, and I told my cousin, I said, well, look a little deeper. You still got more of Graham's stuff there. Maybe there's that card just floating around there or something.
That's funny.
Yeah, because all of a sudden I started counting cards, and I thought, 51, this is weird. And then I put them all in suits, right in front of me to see what was missing. Went through everyone. I went, there's the Ace of Spades. That's pretty cool. But I really wish that I had known that she had done that, because I'm really curious about how she got the meaning of each card.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities there. Most likely it was probably through trial and error and experimentation, as well as learning it from someone else. So,
yeah, that could be. But yeah, so that's why we should talk about that
for sure
when you get a book or just before you get the book redone or whatever, because it's a fascinating topic. Let's talk a little bit about your radio show or your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Spill it.
Yeah, so that's New World Witch Reads. That's conveniently the same name as the book. We've been doing that for, at this point, we're getting close to 12 years at this point. We've done, I think officially we're about to hit episode 200, but we've really done something like 260 episodes, including special episodes and things like that. Mm-hmm. My partner Lane and I, we talk about folk magic in North America. We explore things. Sometimes we'll explore specific topics, like, for example, seaside or, ocean-based maritime sorcery. We'll talk about weather magic, things like that. We'll pull in folklore, but then we'll also kind of talk about it in sort of a contemporary setting too. And then just about every other episode, I'll do an interview with an actual folk magic practitioner or a knowledgeable scholar on areas of folk magic and talk about all kinds of things. So this has been how I've met people who are doing, for example, Hechicera, right? People who do Pennsylvania German Bracherei or Powwow, right? So this is all this kind of stuff that, I've been very, very lucky to have made contact with so many different practitioners of these systems over the years and be able to talk to them and kind of get them to explain their practices a little bit. So that's really what the show has been over the past dozen or so years. We do other things too. We've got presence on Instagram. We've got a YouTube channel, things like that too. So
where can people find it?
Sure, newworldwitchery.com is the easiest way to find it. But it's also in, yeah, it's pretty straightforward. And then, you know, if you have any kind of a podcasting app, Apple, Google, Spotify, any of those, we come up as soon as you search for New World Witchery. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like we get our podcasts all over the place now. Before it was just like one place, you know, like Podomatic or something. But right. Now it just goes all over the place. We're going to have to go pretty quick, but I remembered now that somebody asked me to ask you to talk about the Zodiac Garden.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit. A lot of people are interested in plants and growing.
Sure. So this is the idea of planting by the signs, which, I mean, if you pick up the Farmer's Almanac, it will walk you through that just as easily as my book will, because it's been such a part of North American folk culture for so long. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was producing almanacs that had this information in them. So basically the idea is that the moon goes through different zodiac signs. Every month it goes through about every 3 days, it'll change the sign that it's in. And depending on what sign the moon is in, that can affect the kind of things that you can expect to happen. So when it's in kind of a dry or arid sign, like, for example, I think Aries is considered dry or arid, you shouldn't be doing a lot of planting, right? You should be working on clearing out weeds, things that you don't want to grow back, burning old brush, doing your composting. But when you have more of a fruitful sign, for example, one of the water signs, maybe that would be one where you would be okay to pick the plant or pick the stuff that's growing above ground at that point, right? Or if mm-hmm. you've got, I think maybe it might be Pisces or Capricorn, when you're supposed to do the root vegetables, because they represent, I think Pisces represents the feet, so it's kind of the lowest thing, which makes sense for root vegetables. Mm-hmm. And then Capricorn is kind of the earth and underground sort of sign. So it's all kind of related to this, but literally you can go into an almanac and it will tell you every day what sign the moon is in, and it will tell you this information about, like, well, okay, today you should plant this, or today you should not be planting at all, today you should be harvesting, stuff like that. So it's pretty common, pretty widespread, very, very common in the South to find people that use this system.
Yeah. I mean, it's more comprehensive than what you're saying, because you go by the different seasons and yes. signs and everything. So, yeah. So, I mean, there is something for everybody in this book, seriously, and more than one thing, probably.
I hope so.
But if anybody wants to get it, just remember it's a little bit heavy. It's almost 500 pages, and 400 and something. And everything you want to know about anything is there, practically, you know. So thank you for writing such a really comprehensive book.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Hopefully people will find stuff that they like and can use in it. So
they will. And you don't have to be witchy. You know, you can just be folksy and enjoy it as well.
Absolutely.
So one more time, give out your website address.
Sure. Newworldwitchery.com.
Very, very easy. And what can people find on your website? Just about everything, right? The show, the
Absolutely,
books.
Yeah. We have like 200 articles on various types of folk magic. We have all of our podcast episodes, all of our social media links. You can find the book. Everything is there. So,
the one-stop shop.
It is.
All right. Well, again, thank you for being here and sharing the book. And it truly is a treasure trove.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. This is delightful. This really did fly by. That hour went so fast.
I know. Well, you got to come back. That's all. Just that Absolutely. Simple. And let's thank everybody for listening in as well.
Yes, thank you. And thank you so much.
Until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009.
You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.